Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Need Some Introduction. I'm your host, Victor, and in this podcast, I try to introduce you, the listener, to something new that you may want to listen to or watch, usually TV programs, but not exclusively. If you are a regular listener to this podcast, you know that I mentioned that I would be publishing a Guy Ritchie-related episode in this slot, discussing his adaptation of his own film, The Gentleman, very popular on Netflix, as well as his new film in theater starting just this weekend. And that episode is on the way. However, I've called an audible here and Sona will be on vacation next week. So I will be able to publish that Gentleman episode, including that Guy Ritchie retrospective. And I'll also be publishing an episode recapping the finale of Shogun. But in this slot, I had a show that had popped up on my radar, a new Hulu based on a true story crime drama called Under the Bridge, based on the bestseller with the same name. And Sona and I will be discussing that new series later in this very episode. So basically, I wanted to have a conversation with her before she became unavailable. And it also made me think about some of the things I've seen recently that I'd like to recommend or discuss. The series deals with these disposed of children, mostly young women, up in Victoria, British Columbia. And it's based on this nonfiction book, also called Under the Bridge, by Rebecca Godfrey, who sadly died of lung cancer just a few years before the production of the series. As a matter of fact, just as the series was greenlit. And as is outlined in the series itself, she was actually from this part of Canada, was living in New York, had already had a relatively successful book, and was returning to her hometown to explore the issues of her youth. And that ends up dovetailing with this murder investigation. So I was really intrigued by this. It has echoes of Mare of Easttown, which Sona and I covered here in the podcast years ago. And I thought it would be something interesting to discuss with her. And I found the series very interesting. Two episodes are available currently, and I can't wait to hear her thoughts on it as well. That is coming later. But before, I have some recommendations, some mini reviews that also deal with the traumas we endure over the course of our lifetimes. All of these are not necessarily true crime related. Most of them are true crime related, but just based on actual biographies. And I do think some of these recommendations here do dovetail into the themes here of this show as well. Okay, I'd like to start things off with a brief review of The Iron Claw. Now, this film came out in theaters around Christmas time, came out with a relatively small initial release, but strong word of mouth, got it to about $30 million at the box office. This is from production studio A24, having a hot streak recently. They just had Civil War, which we covered here in a podcast just a couple weeks ago. And this film is directed by Sean Durkin, who's only made a few films. He's produced quite a few films, but only made a few films. One that I've recommended here on the podcast before, his debut film, or actually I think it may have been his second film, Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, which featured a star-making turn for Elizabeth Olsen before she became Wanda Maximoff in the Avengers films. And a relatively early performance by Christopher Abbott as well. That's a great film, very highly recommended, by the way, and also dovetails with some of the themes of this Under the Bridge. A young woman gets in way over her head. In that case, she is joining a cult. I do believe it's available to stream again, possibly on Netflix. I did see it pop up recently, and it's a really excellent film. But Sean Durkin has had this interesting career, has made relatively few films. And this one, Iron Claw, is about the tragedy of the Von Erichs, which is a family of wrestlers from Texas. In popular culture, the conversation here is that Zac Efron, who gives an excellent performance, by the way, got completely jacked for this role. I mean, he's physically completely transformed. He's packed on 25 pounds of muscle, probably. And his wrestling brothers are played here by Jeremy Allen White from The Bear, of course, which we've covered here in a podcast multiple times. Harris Dickinson, who we just saw in Murder at the End of the World and Triangle of Sadness, both covered here in the podcast. And their patriarch is played by Holt McCallany, who's just this great character actor. You've seen him 100 times. He's been in David Fincher's Netflix series, Mindhunter, among other things. But one thing I want to call out, I do not think this is available on Hulu or the FX app anymore, but there's a 1-season series about him as an aging boxer who is starting to have the onset of dementia and is trying to hide it as he's trying to make this comeback simultaneously. And the series is called Lights Out, and he's fantastic in it. The series is fantastic. Was never picked up for a second season, unfortunately. But if you can find it, it's really Lights Out, no pun intended. And he plays the dad here. And another thing that connects this to some of the other content that I'm going to be discussing today you could very well see this patriarch, this father character, Fritz, based on an actual character called Fritz Van Erich, as the villain of this piece. And as a matter of fact, the toxicity of his withholding of affection to his sons is a central theme of this whole entire thing. But they do make him a very sympathetic character. You do see him as a good father, and that's part of the abuse. The withholding of the adoration, the forcing of this competition on his boys for his affection is part of his abuse. But he's part of this cycle as well. And what plays out in the course of the film is sometimes just simple bad twists of fate, but sometimes directly correlated to this toxic competitiveness within the family, leads to one tragedy after another. And as a matter of fact, some of the characters have been conflated here intentionally to streamline the story. If you do check out the Vice series, The Dark Side of the Ring, for the episode on the Von Erichs, if you want additional material after watching this, it's available on YouTube. Honestly, the tragedy of the family goes even deeper than what we see here, but even this is rough. All the performances are really terrific. I especially want to call out Maura Tierney, who I haven't seen in too many things recently, as the mom here, and her silently sitting by and allowing these things to happen and witnessing what happens to her sons is utterly devastating. The film's not perfect. The wrestling scenes are, for the most part, very convincing. I'm not a huge wrestling fan, so I'm sure there's nits to pick here. But for me, I found it relatively convincing all the way throughout. The performances across the board, really excellent. And really exploring this trap of fetishizing expectations of masculinity and imposing that on your kids. And the biggest surprise in the film for me, it really stands out, is when Maura Tierney's character is describing the first time she had met the father, Fritz. And she described that she had never seen a more well-rounded man before. He was an athlete, but he was also a classically trained clarinetist and was actually on a music scholarship in college when he transitioned, really focused on football, and then his failed football career led him to his wrestling career. And of course, it was a different period of time, but it does really drive home the point that these expectations that he put on himself to achieve within this particular arena, even though he had these other fascinations, and how he kind of subverted those aspects of his personality and then single-mindedly focused on this achieving these success himself as well as his sons, in this performative, extremely performative, obviously it's wrestling, it's staged for the most part, representation of masculinity. It's really an interesting, dense thematic exploration of the potential negative side of this kind of fixation, pushing your body or destroying your body, and in so doing, destroying your relationships around you as well. It doesn't do the best job of exploring all these things, so it doesn't succeed 100%, but for the most part, the representation of the love between these brothers really, really works. And man, the last scenes of this film really hit me hard. It's like emotionally really a knockout punch. So that's The Iron Claw. It's available to rent right now. It will be available to stream soon on HBO. They have not officially announced the day yet, but A24 has an exclusive streaming relationship now with HBO. So that should be available any day now on HBO. Keep your eyes peeled. It'll probably be one of those Saturday premieres. But if you'd like to catch up on it right now, it's available to rent or buy via all your digital platforms. Speaking of toxic masculinity and true crime related material, the next topic is a series that I started watching last week. Honestly, I've stopped halfway through. I will finish the series, but even halfway through the series, especially because episode 4, the midpoint of the season, is so powerful. It's honestly one of the most impressive hours of TV. I don't even think it's an hour. I think it's probably closer to half an hour, honestly. Let's just say episode of TV that I've seen a very long time. This is a show that was kind of under the radar, so I wasn't even going to bring it up. But now it appears to be jumping up the charts on Netflix. As a matter of fact, this morning I checked on Netflix, and I believe this is number 2 right now on the Netflix chart. So it has definitely gained a lot of traction this week, and understandably so. The series is called Baby Reindeer, and it's based on a stand-up act. This isn't comedy, by the way, but I guess it was a live performance. This kind of anti-comedy that has become popular among comedians now. Someone who I'd never seen before, by the way, somewhat famous in England, this actor called Richard Gadd. This is based on his own true life story, this experience he had where he was stalked by this woman when he was a bartender in a bar maybe a decade ago at this point. And he has fictionalized this character somewhat, Donnie, he calls himself in the series. And he has written this based on his own material and directed as well. And what a surprise this series was for me. I started watching it. I didn't watch the trailers. I thought it was going to be a very black comedy about someone who's being stalked, a man in this case being stalked by a woman. All of this sounded interesting, but I was like, well, let me just sample it. What we've seen up until episode 4 was how he allowed this woman to infiltrate his life. At one point, he knows she's a stalker. He finds her online, discovers that she is a convicted stalker, and somehow this codependent relationship continues to develop. And by the time he's able to stand up and try to put his foot down, it's too late. She's fully infiltrated and started to destroy his relationships, even his professional life. And here's what happens in episode 4. So minor spoilers here. We discover that he had been sexually assaulted as an adult by another man who, in a very Me Too-like way, had offered to help him get a leg up in his career, and how this abuse escalates because of this quid pro quo. Very, very difficult episode of TV to watch, by the way, right? It reenacts his in flashback, the assault, but much more importantly, is his personal fallout from the assault. He has a sexual awakening, and then he is not certain if this is something that is his true nature or whether it was triggered by this assault. And the guilt and the confusion around that, in a way, is him psychoanalyzing himself here within the context of the show. It's almost as if he has used this stalker who's giving him this unrequited attention as a balm to his ego, but also she represents this person who's giving him something and yet abusing him at the same time, which is his own way of punishing himself for the assault in the past. It's such an interesting and complicated view of the relationship that an abuse survivor has with the abuse. Am I somewhat culpable? And something I had never even thought about until this moment of seeing this show, honestly. Someone who has survived abuse, how nefarious the act is, because it steals away your personhood, even outside of the direct consequences of the assault itself. Anyway, I'm only halfway through. I needed a break after that episode, not only because it was tough to watch, yes, but more importantly, because there's a lot to digest there. So I took a little break there. I will definitely be returning to it, but I can't imagine that even if the remainder of the season, there's only 8 episodes, they're relatively short, so a pretty quick binge. And I don't know if you want to binge this, but it is a quick binge. Even if it pales in comparison to the buildup in the back half, it is still quite an achievement and very brave for this filmmaker. In my analysis, this is my one ding on, and maybe there's more, so maybe I should reserve this slight critique here. Has nothing to do with the film, the series itself, which I think is excellent. And there may be another shoe to drop before the end of the series itself. But I did find it interesting that obviously it's a matter of record. So not in the show where people use aliases, but in the context of his interviews, in the public record, he does explain who his stalker was in real life, I should say, but has not come forward with the name of this sexual predator. And obviously, it's everybody's choice to do that or not. But I do wonder if this was correlates directly to someone who's in the entertainment field who may be doing this to other people, maybe something he should address in public. I may cut all that out because maybe I should wait until the show ends to see if indeed he does come forward with this. And once again, that's Baby Reindeer. Baby Reindeer because that is one of the strange nicknames that this stalker gives to him in her thousands and thousands of emails that she sends him from many, many fake email accounts. And that is currently available on Netflix and is very popular. So maybe it doesn't need me to help promote it, but just my review of it. Really impressed by the courage and the execution of very difficult material. Okay, so if you want a bummer of a night, go watch those. But I have another show that might be a bummer, but still, I think, very well made. And I'm going to get into that conversation right now, discussing this series, Under the Bridge, available currently on Hulu, 2 episodes out already. And let's get into that conversation with Sona right now. Hello, Sona. I haven't talked to you in a couple of weeks. Have you seen the new Bluey episode, the special?
Of course I have.
Okay. So I wanted to get you on the podcast because I know you're going on vacation and wanted to grab you while I could. And there was a new show that popped up on the radar, was not on my expectations to cover this. By the way, in this episode, I actually threw some other based on true story films and series that I've watched recently. So it just became interesting thematically to have this conversation. Of course, that's all dependent on whether I liked this show, which oftentimes I try to watch these shows. I do not get into them, but I really did like this one, to be honest. It's only two episodes in, so it could all fall apart in the end, but I did enjoy it up until this point. Enjoy is a rough word for this type of show, but I did find it interesting, let's say. I have a couple of recommendations for the audience at large and for you, Sona, too. I saved some of my recommendations here for this part of the conversation because I did want to call it out. The first one is the Amy Winehouse biopic Back to Black is already playing in England, has already been released there, and is coming to the US very shortly. And I wanted to recommend the documentary called Amy, Academy Award nominated just a few years ago. This is from Asif Kapadia. He also, by the way, just another recommendation here, he made a documentary series called 1972, The Year That Music Changed Everything, which is available on Apple TV and is excellent. And it's a breakdown of this really seminal music that came out from 1972. And we covered it here in a podcast. So do check out that episode and do check out that documentary. It's really good. But I wanted to call this out, not only because I find this to be one of the best documentaries I've seen in years. It's also fascinating the way this is constructed. There are no talking heads. There are no interviews. There are no moments in the movie when you are out of chronological order. We live in a world now where everything is recorded constantly, including Amy Winehouse when she was a teenager performing her very first time in a club. And the movie basically opens there where you see her not only perform on stage as a teenager, incredible how she is so poised and so adept as a performer, even as a teenager. But on that same videotape, we also see her another dual unfortunate, tragic path for her. We also see her doing drugs with other people recorded on video inside the bathroom before she goes on stage. So you see it right there at the very beginning. But the documentary itself is all assembled from archive footage. It's as if you're watching a movie, but all made up of actual footage. And it is absolutely incredible. We get this toxic relationship with her dad. He becomes a contestant on this BBC TV series, one of these I'm a celebrity, get me out of here type shows. And you see how he is really preying on her infamy at this point because she's already come out of rehab and she's become a tabloid fixture at this point. And the moments where he is basically saying these really terrible things about how he is using this as a way to get famous is actually from the reality show. So it's incredible how everything is assembled from this found footage. And I cannot imagine how difficult it was to construct this thing, but it is absolutely astounding. Mm-hmm. And I was a fan of Amy Winehouse. She doesn't have that much music, but I'll tell you that after I watched this, I was like, this woman was a genius. She was a lyrical genius. Wow. And I was so impressed with her being able to, in the recording studio, just improvise some incredible lyrics right off the top of her head. Yeah, she, I just so impressed by her and a real loss. Once again, another one of these tragic losses in the recent years, but highly recommended, and it's easy to stream. I think it might also be on Netflix right now, but very easy to find, Amy. And of course, probably going to be better than the biopic, which I haven't seen yet, so I can't really judge it. Mm-hmm. But I do want people to watch the Amy documentary, which is just absolutely extraordinary. And one more recommendation, which is directly aligned with maybe this series we're going to touch on, also created in the same manner, something that is assembled from actual footage, is a movie called American Murder, The Family Next Door on Netflix. And this is the story of Chris Watts, this Colorado native who murdered his family. Have you seen this, Sona, by chance?
No, I
haven't. This is also fascinating. And like I mentioned before, the opening, cold open of this documentary is the Ring camera where the neighbors are concerned that they haven't seen the wife in a while. And you literally see them via the Ring camera waiting for the police to arrive. And then when the police shows up, we see the next few minutes of the investigation from the police officer's body camera. And the entire film, once again, mm-hmm. is all created from the footage itself, the actual footage from Ring cameras and the police interviews and social media posts. It's another really remarkable, just the construction of a documentary, but also extremely difficult to watch. This story about this man who basically to pursue a affair or to extend an affair that basically annihilated his entire family is one of the most disgusting things you can imagine ever happening. And it's just so tragic to see, for example, social media posts where he is playing with his children in the background while she is live blogging. And you know that on the same day is going to murder this whole entire family. It's gut churning, and you can't even imagine the mindset of someone like this. But seeing the actual footage rather than some kind of reenactment of it, it's pretty remarkable. So I do recommend that, although it's a tough watch. Oh, and one more thing I wanted to call out. Sona, did you see The Jinx? Did you ever watch The Jinx?
Oh, I did back in the day. Yeah. My memory of it isn't that great.
Definitely. The season 2 of The Jinx is coming this weekend to HBO. So one more thing to just with this true crime Lollapalooza that we have here. So yeah, I had mentioned this to you. I was like, do you want to check this out? Maybe it'll be something you like. And I did really much like this. What did you think of Under the Bridge here on Hulu?
I liked it. I liked it a lot. And I think there is a lot to like about it. It feels a little bit like East Town, a little bit like Gone Girl. It has the true story aspect to it, which I personally am not familiar with the true story behind it. So I have no idea where it's going. And I've decided now that I've started watching it to not look up the true story so I can be along for the ride. This is kind of a weird thing to say if it's based on a true story, but I like that it's very female centered. I like that it's featuring a South Asian family that are Jehovah's Witnesses, which is not something I've seen before. I think the girl who's playing Josephine, the young woman who's playing Josephine, is doing an amazing job of portraying a character that is not likable, but still very interesting to watch. And you want to know more about her. I just feel like there's a lot to like about this.
Yeah, I felt the same way. And just so you know, I did do a very cursory review of the actual case, maybe like first paragraph of a People's magazine article. And I found it really surprising, even as I was in episode 1, I looked at just this very short capsule article about the case. And even details that I was surprised to be like, well, maybe this is fictionalized, or there's certain details that they're not delving into. For example, the mom being a Jehovah's Witness, and this is something that's not fully explained here yet, but that there were false accusations made against the father, which...
Yeah, they have laid
exactly. And they, I was like, oh, they're not going to get into that. And by episode 2, we've already started to touch on it or hint at things that are going to be in there. So I think it's going to be very factually based. And also that the author herself, I thought this was fictionalized, but she was indeed from Victoria, British Columbia. She was there to research a book that she was working on about the girls in this area, troubled girls. And of course, coincidentally, this case erupts right on point in the midst of her being there. So it's seems to be very closely correlated to the case itself, which doesn't really matter, to be honest with you. I find the ideas are interesting. And as the father of a daughter, I am very concerned with the psychology of teenage girls when you hear the nightmare stories.
Just watching these two.
Oh, my God. Yes. Very stressful. And I have a question for you. So the girl who plays Rina, this actress of Ritka Gupta, I was really impressed because, to be honest, when I first was introduced to the character, I was thinking maybe because we know she's going to be the victim of a crime, we're not going to spend much more time with her. And she's going to be this kind of really annoying, good girl gone bad, but like almost like a stereotypical character. And we have no real psychological insight into her. And the performance was a little one note. Of course, she has relatively short screen time in that first episode. But I was really impressed. And this is why I would recommend the show at this moment. And where I was so intrigued was that it wasn't the show that I expected it to be, in the fact that we now flashback and we see her, a different version of this girl, just a year earlier. And the performance is really good. We see that she's going to have a transformation from the girl we see a year earlier to the girl who ends up in this circumstance by the end of the show. I thought that was really well done. And also that they really seem to be very interested in the psychology of all these characters. This author who has her own troubled past, the Lily Gladstone character who from Flowers of Killer Moon, hey, if you want to think about that as another trauma-based true crime story, that is also had that Academy Award nomination for that excellent film. available on Apple TV, by the way, for anybody who wants to catch up on that as well. She has her own past. She is a minority woman in this town that is mostly white. There's some level of empathy there with the Rena character as well, or this actual true life person. But also we see, like you mentioned, Archie Punjabi from The Good Wife, by the way. And we also saw her. What did we see her in? Oh, in Hijack, right? I think she was underused in the series Hijack. But here, I think she gets to play a pretty complex character. And you do wonder about her, right? She is a Jehovah's Witness in this family that obviously is not Jehovah's Witness. And that is part of the strain and the alienation between her and her daughter. So I think the show is very interested in all the psychology of all these different characters. And like you mentioned before, a very female perspective. Maybe the men are not very well sketched out here. They're just pretty much chauvinist pigs, and so far, anyway. Although I'd say that there is some complexity, I think, within Rena's family, because her cousin and her dad both are, once again, not the stereotypical characters you would expect to see in this type of story. So, yeah, I'm very intrigued by all of this, and it's very well directed. I think the tone management here is intriguing and dark, but stylish. Yeah, I'm very impressed with everything I've seen so far.
Yeah, I definitely am interested in seeing how this story develops. And I personally can't remember, it doesn't mean it's not out there, but I don't remember recently seeing an ensemble type cast of teenage girls. So that's a novelty to me to be able to watch young women of that age. And it's like a fairly diverse group, it feels like. So I'm very interested in that aspect as well.
We also get to hear a lot of 90s music, which is always something that's fun.
The music is good. Yeah.
They even throw a little Sonic Youth in there. I'm like, wow, they're going pretty deep. This is something that's beyond the text of the show so far, but maybe it makes me raise the question now. You, of course, have experience of being a teenage girl. It is in the 90s, no less, but I have trouble sympathizing with this character, although I think they're doing a good job of giving her psychological background, who is actively rebelling against her family to the extent that she's damaging her father's reputation, just for one thing, so that she could end up in a reform school with these troubled girls. And I mean, in watching this or just in personal experience, do you have any feedback for that? Like, do you find that to be believable in some way, that someone could be so self-destructive at that age? I guess teenagers can be self-destructive for sure, but it seems to be, and I guess this will be explored over the course of the series, but what a drastic actions to take here.
I think maybe you're bringing a little insight into this that I haven't necessarily seen yet in the first two episodes. I could be wrong though, but yes, I do think teenagers can be very self-destructive. I do think that having a sense of belonging is really essential in the teenage years. And when you don't have that, I think it can be very damaging. So I guess it can be a perfect storm depending on the type of person you are to begin with and your personality type, how extreme you are. I think some people could just withdraw and become a loner and do their own thing, and other people might take extreme measures in order to have that sense of place in life. But it doesn't seem like a good life that these big girls are living, right? It doesn't seem like something that anybody rational would want.
It was a little surprising to me, too, to see this dichotomy between what you would assume to be mostly well-off families. I don't know how wealthy the author's family actually was. Her parents were both writers, I believe, in her actual biography, Godfrey's actual biography. Godfrey, by the way, died of lung cancer at 54, believe it or not, just a few years ago when this show had already or was about to go into production. So surprising to hear that. But her parents were both writers. I don't know if the biography is going to be exactly the same here in the book, but you see this incredibly. I know you like real estate porn. This is an incredible lake house or like lakefront house they live in. Mm-hmm. And when she returns home, you see the dichotomy of that versus where these girls are, which there seems to be a whole culture in this place. Like you said, they call them big girls of these disposed of teenage girls, which was kind of surprising to see this, right?
First of all, I don't know if the concept of foster homes still exists. I know the concept of foster parents still exists, But Betsy was very much in tune with our childhood. And then they would make a Saturday morning show about it, about all these random kids who are together growing up. And it would be like a feel-good show. So the idea of a foster home like this existing socioeconomically in the same place as these other things are happening does seem very strange. Yeah. I guess this is in Canada,
yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. So maybe I'm bringing some kind of American perspective to it that is affecting me. But usually things are not that socioeconomically intermingled, especially because this town does not seem very dense.
Right. Yes, right? Exactly.
Like, I can understand when at a certain point, the population density is such that it is going to be very diverse in one way or another. But here, it seems like a more small townish kind of feel, not like tiny town, but I am surprised to see so many things coexisting in the same space. But maybe in Canada, that's not so unusual.
I guess it's the stereotype, not only of the United States, and it does speak to the strange racialization of poverty in this country. And, you know, there's a whole discourse on what that means and how it kind of in some way proves that there is racism in this country or everywhere, I guess, in the world. But I always find it really interesting when I watch shows set in Britain, for example, these biographical films where people grew up extremely impoverished. And of course, now in this British Columbia district as well, or sometimes honestly, just seeing similar material covered for people who grew up like in the Seattle area or something is always to see that there is always poverty, right, in these areas. And there's always these kind of neglected children, but it's not racialized, right? Because the population's all Caucasian usually, or extremely Caucasian. So in other words, it's interesting that there's always an underclass. And if there is a racial minority, then that will be the underclass. But if there's not, it still right. exists. It's just as not racialized. Yeah. I guess there are other ways to alienate these folks, whether it is based on their jobs or their biographies or whether they've been in trouble with the law or such. But it's just a different set of criteria, but it's always an underclass, basically. So it is interesting to see it from that perspective. What is really fascinating to me of the psychology, I guess this is what is going to be explored in the course of the show, is when somebody is not in that underclass and chooses literally to get herself, once again, I'm going a little bit into probably like episode 3, but in the biography of the actual girl who got herself put into foster care so that she could hang out with these girls. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine, obviously being a voyeur and, you know, hanging out with the rough crowd is something that teenagers do all the time. But the idea that you would be so alienated from your own family, that it does not seem to be an abusive family, by the way, maybe neglectful emotionally a little bit, but not, these are just shades of this at this moment in the show, but that you would make that choice. It was kind of shocking to see, actually, to be honest. And maybe troubling. Once again, I'm reading a lot into this because I have a young daughter and I'm a little scared.
Depending on how they develop this story, you can, if you feel like you have a safety net, you can make some riskier choices.
That's true.
Right?
You can always go home, yeah.
If you feel like, well, if this all goes bad, I'll just go back home. And I think that's something that, like, in my life, I have noticed the difference between choices that I have made and choices that people with more of a safety net than I happen to have made. I think it does allow you to take some gambles. But again, like this, I don't know. I understand there's a camaraderie and a clickiness and even an actual gang here, right, that's happening with these girls. So you want to be a part of that. But it does seem like your quality of life is going to suffer living in that environment compared to where she's coming from, no matter how much fun it is to just hang out with your friends all the time. But maybe to her, it was like a summer camp kind of experience, right? Like you rough it for a few months and then you go home.
Maybe, but I mean, when you end up in foster care, and not only that, but there's hinted out here that they dismiss her as a missing person at the beginning of the series because she's run away from home many times before. So she desperately wants to get out of that house. And I assume that we will at least get the show or the book's version of what she was trying to run away from. But once again, it does not seem to paint the mother, who is a Jehovah's Witness and maybe very strict in her religious beliefs, but does not seem to be abusive in any other way, and a very gentle father character here.
Mm-hmm.
So it does not seem to be an unloving home. It may be strict, but not an unloving home. And that right. is surprising to see. It's just basically not a story I've seen before, which is part of the reason I'm so fascinated with how it continues. Just to get into the plot of the show a little bit, in the first episode, we see this author has returned home. She is a surrogate for the actual author who grew up in this area of British Columbia. There is a murder investigation occurring at the time because this young girl who, as we mentioned, outlined here, she's had this rough relationship with her parents. The police at first think that she may just run away, but over the course of the series, there's a police officer who's a Lily Gladstone's character, who is also a minority, a Native American, adopted by a white family, and one of the few minorities in this town, which of course is important because we also see, for example, that Rena is immediately an outsider for the fact that she is one of the few minorities here. And there's also in this gang of girls that she hangs out with is also a black girl who also has an affinity for her, once again, because they're probably relatively few outsiders. Mm-hmm. But the head of the gang, or the most charismatic character here, is this Josephine character, Joe, who seems to draw these girls to her. And she has this fantasy that she is going to meet John Gotti and to be a gangster. And she has this really preposterous view of reality, of course. And we can see that as adults. But I'm sure that if you live in this very small town and you are an outsider, this girl who embraces all her otherness is probably compelling.
There's always a queen bee.
Yes.
For one reason or another.
Exactly. My daughter's about to go see the Mean Girls musical tonight. This is a high school production, so don't get too excited.
It'll be super.
The show surprises me in the way it's telling the story, but this is where the show's not really twist-based, doesn't seem to be. It seems to be more interested in the psychology of the characters. But there is one little twist at the very end of episode 2, which is that this has been set up until this point to look like Joe, who's taken credit for killing Rena, is the prime suspect here, obviously, and she probably is the murderer. And then, spoiler for episode 2, that she's shocked that she actually is dead. So it seems like she was, once again, just like her, trying to puff up her reputation as a tough girl. This was something she was just taking credit for. But there is yet another killer that we have not yet discovered here.
A couple of things. First of all, I guess because I watch so many suspenseful shows, because it's a favorite of mine, I was just expecting the setup when they introduced the author and whatever. I thought there were going to be like a dual timeline.
Yes, I thought so as well. Yes.
Right? Like it seemed like the writer was going to start investigating this.
Like she was the bad girl, right? That she's the bad girl and this is her coming back to town and now reflecting on the case. Yes.
Exactly. So I know I was trying to figure out, like, was she one of these girls in this scene? So it surprised me in its straightforward storytelling. And then, yes, here with the reveal, but I think it was also telegraphed that Joe is trying to take credit for this thing that she didn't do. And now she's shocked that it actually did happen. I thought this was a good, I don't know how true to life it is.
Yeah.
But I thought this was a good way to set up this story and her character. And I feel like she's going to be a very complex character and I'm interested in getting to know more about her.
Yeah. And honestly, if it was just a reveal of this murder investigation, and this is why I think it's interestingly does dovetail back to Mayor of Easttown, which obviously, because it's fictional, gets to have that shocking twist in episode 5, et cetera, which I don't expect to see in here. Maybe there'll be a shock as to who the actual killer is, although I do think it'll be true to the actual case. More importantly, is that the show very much seems to be interested in delving into the psychology of all these characters. And I do think that is what it's going to be its focus throughout. And once again, like Mayor of Easttown, which I think that show obviously was about the investigation, but it's really more about the interactions and the histories and the relationships between those characters. And even Kate Winslet's character, for example, her relationship with her daughter, but also her obsession with her work. So it was really more about the characters than it was about the mystery. And another show, by the way, that was an inspiration for Mayor of Easttown that I'm going to throw out there now because it's available. The show just wrapped up, the entire series just wrapped up last year, which was Happy Valley, the British series, which no one's ever seen that, excellent. And once again, always an investigation, but really way more interested in the psychology of the characters. Of course, in this particular case, this is an actual true life story.
Right.
So there might be some limitations on how much they can fictionalize, but I found this really interesting. I was very engaged throughout so far.
Yeah, I agree. And I think I read that it's not that many episodes. I think it's only
I think it's eight. It's a mini series. Yeah, I think it's 8 episodes.
I find that usually that really keeps it moving.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And so, yeah, I find that more enjoyable to watch generally. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how the plot develops. And I think it will develop fairly quickly.
And relatively short episodes, by the way. I'm watching Shogun right now, which is absolutely incredible. It's wrapping up next week. But these are very long episodes, well over an hour. And they need the extra time. But I watched like Fallout, which was entertaining enough. I reviewed it here at a podcast last week. And that was a science fiction show. And those episodes are like an hour and 10 minutes long. And I'm like, these episodes do not need to be this long. Or they should be like 2 30-minute episodes. Make these more bite-sized. There's no reason to make these things so long. But this is not that long. It really feels like television. I like that there's some shows recently that remembered how to make television.
Right.
this seems to feel like that. I can even imagine this was originally like going to be like an ABC Family show, by the way, because I don't see anything that's too not right. television friendly. Probably with an N14 rating, you could probably get away with everything that's in this show. But that's not to ding it, as it doesn't feel like young adult, for example. It feels very mature and very intelligent so far. The performances are all terrific. I forgot to mention that Riley Keough is one of the main stars here, along with Lily Gladstone. The girls, I think, are all really giving good performances. Even more so, they outclass the adult characters as well. But of course, it's very early in the going, and the story really is focused around the girls. So,
yeah, totally agree. The girls here are so interesting to watch, and I'm really curious to see how their characters develop. And I already have a fondness for them just based on these couple of episodes.
Right. Great. So we will probably check back in. I don't think we're going to go week to week on this show. In the meantime, Sona, in about 2 weeks, probably when you get back from vacation, another FX show, which is also going to be streaming on Hulu right after Shogun wraps up. They're following up the success of that with hopefully another big success, which is a spy thriller starring Elizabeth Moss called The Veil. And maybe we'll sample that as well.
Definitely. Is this show, Under the Bridge, it's one episode being released a week? Is that the
one
deal?
One per week, yeah.
Okay, that's going to be rough.
That'd be slow going. Oh, and one more thing I wanted to call out. Also available on Hulu for anybody. And once again, Sona, if you like this, you may very well like this other show as well. This show is called The Girl from Plainville. Did you ever watch this?
No, I haven't heard of it again.
Oh, really? Okay. So this came out, I think, a year ago. It might be two at this point. The pandemic has confused me with time in general. But this stars Elle Fanning. She gives a great performance playing Michelle Carter. There's also a documentary about her on HBO, if you want to watch it there, or Max, I guess it's called. This is about this girl. I think she was from Maryland, and she was texting. She had a text-based relationship with this boy called Conrad Roy. They actually met when they were vacationing together at some point. Their families separately were vacationing. They ran into each other and they kept a text conversation going back and forth. And she basically had this codependent relationship with him and eventually goaded him, at least that's the story, goaded him into committing suicide.
Yes, I know the real life story.
You do know the story. Okay. So this is based on that. This show had pretty good critical response, but audiences were very negative on it because, and I found it really interesting, because everybody's opinion was, she is a one-dimensional monster. She's a devil. Look at her eyebrows like this, like really judging her by her appearance. And they're saying, why are you trying to make her sympathetic? And I do want to call that out because, once again, you have a villainous, potentially young woman who gets a somewhat sympathetic portrayal. And a lot of people read that as saying like, they're blaming him for this suicide and not giving her enough culpability. And what I liked so much about this, I really highly recommend this series. And I thought the finale was so touching in surprising ways that I don't want to spoil here. I was really impressed with the way it was made. And I think if you're looking for someone to just simply vilify someone who did something bad, you're not going to get that in the show. But if you want to see a very complicated perspective of a girl who did something terrible, who is culpable to some extent for the tragedy that occurs to this boy, but also how this boy had these mental problems and how his family, he had multiple suicide attempts earlier in his life, and how it was this idea of, well, we don't really want to talk about that. Let's not really deal with it. So it's not to say that they're to blame either. That's another thing I want to be clear in me saying this. I'm not blaming the family either for not taking enough action. It is about the messy complexity of this time in your life. And it's so well illustrated. I was really, really impressed with it. and especially Elle Fanning. I think she was just incredible in this performance. Once again, the idea that someone reads this as just making her the victim or something, it's not that simple. She is both the villain and a victim as well. And I think that's what's interesting about it. And once again, I think it dovetails well with the themes of this current series. It's available on Hulu, so check it out if that sounds intriguing to you as well. All right, Sona, so enjoy your time off.
Thank you so much.
And we'll check in with this show and check in with The Veil in a couple of weeks. I'll see how that premiere, I think it's like a 2 or 3 episode premiere. So maybe we'll recap those. And maybe at that point, we'll have whatever, 4 episodes of this. We'll be halfway into this season and we can also see where we're at there.
Sure.
All right. Thanks again.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Bye.